Good evening. I'd like you to welcome you all to this LSE public lecture with Professor Joel Trachman on the World Trade Organization, poverty and global apartheid. My name is Deborah Cass and I will chair this evening's session. Now, recent estimates on world trade have suggested that in the past quarter century or so, world trade has increased by some 17 times. Production is up fourfold. Per capita income has increased approximately twofold. We know also that this rosy picture of global economic welfare has a dark side as well. 1.2 billion people live on less than 70p a day. Half the world's population does not have adequate sanitation. The US alone gives approximately $3.5 billion in subsidies to its farmers, three times what it provides in aid to the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. Tariffs imposed by developed states, generally on agricultural exports from developing countries, are on average four times higher than tariffs imposed between industrialized states on manufactured products. The tale these figures tell is then a depressingly familiar one. Tighter international trade disciplines have improved trade, production and income for some. But the trajectory of economic development in many poorer countries is at best at a standstill and at worst for some in reverse. Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, is now officially more seriously worse off than it was nearly a decade ago when the WTO was established. The causes and responses to this critical situation deserve our immediate concern. Professor Joel Trachman is one of a handful of international trade specialists who have taken this problem seriously. Professor Trachman is Professor of International Law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Boston. He is one of the leading scholars in the WTO field and is a prolific and excellent author. Many of his groundbreaking works have been based on an approach that seeks to marry the insights of economic analysis with law, the law and economics approach. Professor Trachman's career path has taken him in a variety of directions. In fact, his CV is quite breathtaking in its scope and length. As well as practicing as a lawyer in New York and Hong Kong in the area of international business and financial transactions, in recent times, Professor Trachman has had a stint at Harvard Law School. He's consulted for many bodies, including the US Agency for International Development, the World Bank, and UNCTAD. And amongst his more glorious achievements, I should add, he is an alum from this institution, the LSE, having attended here in 1975. In his lecture tonight, Professor Trachman turns this vast experience towards the topic of the WTO, poverty and global apartheid. He considers the ways in which the WTO system might be implicated in the maintenance of a system in which poor countries are disadvantaged, and he addresses some potential solutions. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Joel Trachman. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. It's indeed a real pleasure for me to return to the London School of Economics, where I had a real intellectual awakening, one of many that I've had over the years. And one of the things that I regret about my career at the London School of Economics is that I didn't study economics here. I didn't study much in the way of politics, but concentrated on law. Since becoming a scholar 14 years ago, I've tried to redress some of that legal-centric focus, and some of my colleagues at the Fletcher School, which is an interdisciplinary miniature version, I like to think, of the London School of Economics, suggest that I have economist envy. And so I do feel that some of the methodologies of economics some of the methodologies of the more social scientific political science are extremely useful when they're available, when their domain approaches law. So what I've done in this lecture is I've tried to provide a kind of lawyer's perspective, an interdisciplinarily curious lawyer's perspective on some of the economic and political issues. And so this topic, this extraordinarily difficult topic of global poverty, is one that can only be answered through interdisciplinary activity. And of course, I only have the skills of a lawyer, and what I hope to do in our conversation this evening is to try to bring to bear together some of the other skills and try to develop a conversation about this problem. So from a theoretical standpoint, my talk will address questions of the territorial, or in legal terms, the jurisdictional scope of the market and of the state, of competition and of redistribution. And it's important to recognize that this question of the scope of competition and redistribution has been addressed over the years and varied over the years in our national societies. But now, one of the things that I think that we're seeing is the beginning of a conversation about how the scope of redistribution and the market relate to one another within the international setting, and how that international relationship between the state and the market relates to the national relationships between the state and the market. I think it's an appropriate moment to review the relationship between trade and poverty, and especially between trade law and poverty. The Doha Development Agenda began 18 months ago with a pro-development ministerial declaration, but has been bogged down in agriculture and intellectual property. While the European Union has recently moved to shake things up in agriculture, and pharmaceutical companies seem willing to contribute to the solution to the impasse on drugs, we do not yet know how the Doha agenda will move forward. We will see in September, in part, with the ministerial meeting at Cancun. Recent meetings on financing for development and on sustainable development have advanced discussions of the problems of development. Oxfam and the UNDP have prepared reports on trade and poverty, and other NGOs have become active in this area. Developing countries themselves are showing increasing assertiveness in WTO dispute settlement, with India attacking the EU's conditions on access to its generalized system of preferences for developing countries, and many countries attacking United States administered protection, anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties laws. Let me begin with an example to motivate my topic. During the past five or more years, we have seen many stories about software engineers and call center attendants working in places like Bangalore and Bombay, but doing the same work as could otherwise be done by people in Boston or Birmingham. We might think of these Indians as virtual migrants, competing with workers in other places without actually immigrating and without using the medium of trade in goods. Firms like Microsoft view these workers as a half-price sale. They're delighted to be able to hire these very capable workers at half the cost of a worker in Seattle or elsewhere. And indeed, these multinational corporations serve as engines of price arbitrage, seeking out cheaper and better inputs throughout the world and seeking higher prices for their outputs. Now, some may view this activity as rapacious and destructive, but of course, for the people who take these jobs in India, these jobs serve as a better alternative to whatever else is available to them. And the question we must ask is whether it's appropriate to deny these jobs to those people. And of course, for the people in India, this raises the question of what the role of international trade law should be. Should it be to allow these people to take these jobs, or should it be to protect the workers in Birmingham or Boston from this competition? Prior to the September 2002 Johannesburg summit, Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, described the present international distribution of wealth in terms of global apartheid. We might understand this statement as a reference to a circumstance in which the legal system is used to lock certain people into a position of poverty, inequality, and disenfranchisement, or to artificially separate groups of people. Under apartheid, the accident of birth into a particular race affected one's life opportunities. Under the international system as it exists, the accident of birth into a particular nationality has a similar effect. For a lawyer, it is not simply the territory into which one is born that matters. The core issue is the set of legal rights that citizenship entails. For our trade-oriented purposes, these are rights to exclude, rights to a protected market, which allows super-competitive pricing. To what extent is the trade law system complicit in the creation of a system of global apartheid? Trade liberalization at its core involves the reduction of barriers to equal participation in commerce. So we must say at the outset that the trade law system holds promise for reducing global apartheid. Trade law can be revised to further extend the competitiveness of the market to allow poor people to compete for better wages and better livelihoods. This would be an important component of the destruction of global apartheid, and it can be achieved by using familiar trade law tools. The Doha Ministerial Declaration refers to a number of important market access and other issues of interest to poor people in poor countries. And yet, history suggests a degree of skepticism. As often in GATT and WTO history, efforts to assist poor countries have been limited to cheap talk. Furthermore, there are two possible arguments that the trade law system may actually perpetuate global apartheid. First, if we consider the trade law system, not so much in terms of its requirements for liberalization, but in terms of its permission for national barriers to movement of factors, including goods, services, labor, and capital, in both wealthy states and poor states, we may understand the trade law system as limiting the ability of the poor to trade out of poverty. Is the glass half full or half empty? Second, turning to the requirements of liberalization, if these requirements limit the ability of poor states to choose appropriate policies that will maximize their growth and best ameliorate poverty, do they not have the effect of perpetuating poverty? Even though the global system does not have the racist basis that South African apartheid did, it may have the effect of limiting the ability of poor people to overcome poverty, inequality of life opportunities, and disenfranchisement. Let us move into a twilight zone. Looking beyond the traditional trade concern of contestable markets, the remit of trade law and international law more generally has not yet run in any significant way to non-market governance in the poverty reduction sense, to intentional and explicit redistribution. We know that in trade, there is always a distributive aspect of any rule. But what I mean by intentional and explicit redistribution is redistribution that is not hidden by particular trade law rules, but is designed to overcome poverty. Indeed, the general international legal system has little redistributive capacity. However, if there is a need for redistribution, and the trade law system, the WTO, is viewed as responsible for the management of international economic relations, the WTO the WTO will be subject to criticism until the needed redistribution is implemented at the WTO or elsewhere. So to what extent is this criticism, similar to the environmentalists' criticism that the WTO does not do enough for the environment, justified? If we compare the domestic sphere in wealthier states to the international system, we see that the domestic politics in these states includes a substantially greater capacity for redistribution than does international politics, although we in the United States are seeing something of a reversal of the direction of redistribution. The Fabian Roots of the London School of Economics spoke not only to addressing the needs of the poor in Britain, but to worldwide social justice. The purpose of redistribution may be understood in terms of distributive justice, of social cohesion, or of the price of avoiding disruption of the market. To what extent do these goals apply equally in the global system? To the extent that they do, what institutional or legal mechanisms are needed to achieve them? Thus, there are three main areas for work to improve the position of poor people in the international trade law system. First, market access in wealthy countries. It is clear that opening markets to poor country products, including agricultural products, textiles, and tropical products, is a useful and necessary means to reduce poverty, although the magnitude of the effects of these measures is disputed. Second, reform in poor countries. As many leading trade economists have pointed out, poor countries may achieve substantial benefits from domestic reform, including trade liberalization. The Harvard economist Danny Roderick has raised concerns about the correct sequencing of trade liberalization reforms and has insisted that poor countries need sufficient flexibility to devise and implement reforms that are most suitable to growth. Third is global redistribution, providing more money to poor people to pay for needed medicine, food, and education would also help, in addition to these more trade-oriented activities, but has remained outside the trade law regime. So we ask the question, at least I ask the question, what may lawyers add to the debate about poverty and its alleviation? As I suggested at the outset, the legal profession is not skilled in some of the prescriptive aspects, some of the questions about what the law should be. It's more skilled in identifying what the law is. The discipline of law cannot alone, at least, tell us what the law should be. It's necessary to have a broader social scientific approach, such as that here at the LSE, using economics and other tools to examine the relationship between institutions, including laws, and particular outcomes, to take a consequentialist perspective to analyze particular rules and institutions. And of course, the consequence that we are interested in connection with poverty is poverty reduction. So law doesn't tell us how to achieve poverty reduction, nor does law alone tell us why poverty should be reduced. Rather, our own values informed by ethical theory tell us how to think about the need to reduce poverty and what our own obligations are in connection with poverty reduction. Finally, law tells us little about whether our compatriots and those in other countries will join us in efforts to reduce poverty. This is the domain of politics. And so in addition to economic analysis, consequentialist economic analysis, we also need political analysis to show us what is possible. So what can a legal analyst do? In litigation, lawyers can argue for interpretations of law that may benefit the poor, but this seems like a marginal strategy at best. More valuably, lawyers can participate in research to evaluate the consequences of particular legal rules and engage in research with professionals in other disciplines. Research informed by a complete understanding of legal rules and providing information about their consequences can guide us about the most effective legislative or international treaty-based response. In the next part of the talk, I outline ethical and selfish bases for greater assistance to the poor in the international trade context. In the subsequent part, I review some of the arguments from economics and political economy that market access for poor country goods and services economic reform in poor countries, often including trade liberalization, and redistribution to poor people are critical to poverty alleviation. The final part of my talk suggests in very rough terms the types of legal institutions, the types of legal change that seem required in order to overcome these obstacles. So I turn now to a brief review of some of the ethical and selfish foundations of an obligation to reduce poverty. Looking at a Rawlsian approach to cosmopolitanism and at embedded liberalism following John Ruggie and Karl Polanyi. So the first question is, do we as individuals have an ethical obligation to assist the poor in our own countries? Does this obligation extend to the poor in other countries? Remarkably to me, last Thursday, U.S. President George Bush made the following statement. We believe that human suffering in Africa creates moral responsibilities for people everywhere. It seems a remarkable turnabout from the man who gave us the following quote, first things first is the American people, in both grammatical and substantive terms. We should not underestimate the importance, however, of the leading U.S. politician accepting that the U.S. has a moral responsibility for people in poverty outside the United States, or even inside the United States. What is the nature and extent of our responsibility? If we do not have an obligation to assist the poor, would it nevertheless be useful to us to do so. These are not questions we can answer in any conclusive way here, or perhaps anywhere. I want to describe a Rawlsian rationale for redistribution, and also this embedded liberalism-based, more selfish rationale. The argument for redistribution depends on a kind of global social contract and the possibility of backlash by poor elements if they are not given a sufficient stake in the operation of global society. A Rawlsian analysis of the foundation of ethical responsibility to assist the poor is based on Rawls's use of the original position, the veil of ignorance, which is well known. It's a position in which each individual deciding the structure of society is ignorant as to his or her own position in the eventual society that is constructed. Rawls then seeks to develop an understanding of the principles of justice on which individuals would agree in such a position. His second principle of justice postulates that inequality is only justified to the extent that it is necessary to improve the position of the least well-off members of society. If that principle were applied globally, it would have revolutionary effects. In fact, Rawls, perhaps tragically, argues that this principle of justice only applies within a domestic society. For Rawls, international society lacks the solidarity that is necessary as a predicate for the application of the difference principle, this second principle. On the other hand, political philosophers such as Charles Bates and Thomas Paget argue for a cosmopolitan approach in which each individual, regardless of borders, enters into a global original position. Under this global original position, individuals, fearing that they might in the real world reside in one of the poorest states, or more accurately, that they might be among the poorest persons, would decide on a difference principle in the same way that they would in a domestic original position. This difference principle-based approach is in very broad terms comparable to an approach to distribution based on embedded liberalism, drawing on the work of Polanyi and Ruggie. Polanyi and Ruggie believe that states must regulate the distribution of gains from trade in order to avoid political discontent and ultimately a backlash that would destroy the liberal system, that would destroy the market system. In Ruggie's interpretation, individual states must cushion the domestic losers from the loss of wages, livelihoods, and investments that results from liberalization. Ruggie extends Polanyi's approach to relate free international trade to a domestic welfare state. The embedded liberalism bargain, in short, is one in which the state takes care of its own through regulatory intervention in order to maintain its political ability to liberalize. But importantly, embedded liberalism calls for national regulatory intervention, not global regulatory intervention. Its call for redistribution is state-centered and limited by domestic politics and budgetary capacity. Further, it is important to recognize that global liberalism embedded within a domestic welfare state is not quite analogous to the system envisaged by Polanyi. Polanyi saw the need for society-wide regulatory intervention to make adjustments in connection with a society-wide market. To the extent that we have a society-wide market that extends to the global society, it would be congruent to extend redistributive regulation to that broader social setting. Thus, if the scope of the market is to some degree global, then it would seem appropriate that the scope of regulatory intervention in the market would need to be roughly commensurately global. After all, what would be the purpose of artificially constraining the possible funding for adjustment or of other redistributive regulation to sources within a particular geographic segment of the market? It is important to recognize, with Polanyi's original work and Ruggie's extension, that the regulation that they are concerned with is best understood as implicitly redistributive. The point is not necessarily to provide a certain quality of regulation, but to provide a certain quality of life. It may be that labor regulation, health regulation, environmental regulation, and others are the best means to do this under particular circumstances, but if redistribution is the goal, then taxation and explicit redistribution are the most efficient means, subject to what we might call political transaction costs. And I don't mean to belittle the role of these political transaction costs and the need for what one economist called optimal obfuscation the need under some circumstances to hide redistribution within a program that seems to do something else. There may be circumstances in which regulation is used to redistribute because direct redistribution will be simply too difficult in political terms. This technique, of course, has its ethical and practical problems, but it has even greater problems in the global setting where these regulatory policies are dependent on different national economic, legal, and political systems and cultures. Suppression of differences in order to embed liberalism may be too costly in terms of legitimate regulatory diversity. Moreover, the scope for transnational externalization, for transnational redistribution, may be too greatly constrained by a requirement to act through regulatory means as opposed to direct redistribution. So a true global embedded liberalism would extend to poor countries and would allow them, as well as wealthier countries, to attenuate the risks and costs of liberalism to which their citizens are exposed. The transfers could occur on a global basis and would seem to require global institutions to overcome collective action problems in order to make them effectively. Once extended in this way, in terms of both geographic reach and redistributive scope, the embedded liberalism idea seems to have more in common with the cosmopolitan, Rawlsian ethical perspective than that I described earlier. Of course, its motivations are not based on ethics, but on prudent self-interest. The embedded liberalism concept suggests that in order to protect liberalism from destruction by those who lose, it is necessary to compensate them through regulatory intervention. In a very basic way, this perspective is linked to the Pareto principle in economics. No one can be made worse off in order for a transaction to be considered efficient. One way in which the Rawlsian difference principle and Polanyi's embedded liberalism can be merged is through recognition that to some extent, each of us lives our lives in a real veil of ignorance. That is, over time, we are uncertain as to which group we will belong, whether we will be among the lucky few who hold wealth or among the poorest wraiths. Under these circumstances, the difference principle is simply a hypothetical constitutional arrangement that, in accordance with the Pareto principle, we might actually enter into under uncertainty. The embedded liberalism concept calls for redistribution in order to forestall a backlash. On a very speculative and perhaps even a counterfactual level, we can at least imagine a relationship between poverty and terrorism along these lines. That is, even though there has not yet been identified a causal connection between poverty and terrorism, we may, at least in our imaginations, consider whether terrorism could become the way that the poor disrupt global liberalism. Is the rise of terrorism a kind of backlash against liberalism? Is the correct response to embed liberalism in a regulatory regime? A more peaceful backlash, a threat to withdraw from or disrupt the international trade rules system, took place in the early 1960s when developing countries threatened to leave GATT, the predecessor of the WTO, as a bloc and were able to obtain substantial concessions, at least substantial wording concessions, from the developed countries. A more peaceful backlash may be said to be taking place now and has resulted in the development focus of current negotiations at the WTO and elsewhere. So let me now turn to the Doha Development Agenda and the extent to which we can identify continuity or change in terms of the relationship between the Doha Development Agenda and poverty. Given the desperate and urgent circumstances of so many, the Doha Development Agenda seems rather modest in its scope. It may be that the WTO is not the place to engage in the more extreme measures that are needed. And there are certainly other important contexts in which poverty is addressed, but there still may be room to contemplate further action. Furthermore, as I suggested a moment ago, to the extent that the WTO is identified with global economic management, it may be that the WTO, justly or unjustly, will be subjected to increasing criticism for failure to address poverty issues more completely. The main approach of the WTO to poverty is in terms of so-called special and differential treatment. And special and differential treatment figures prominently in the Doha Development Agenda. But it appears that the concept of special and differential treatment, at least as applied so far, has had limited utility. Special and differential treatment, or S&D for short, is a complex phenomenon. Some aspects of S&D are undoubtedly beneficial. However, this concept seems to mask the fact that the international trade system, the international trade law system in particular, has done little specifically intended to alleviate poverty. It is not special and differential enough, one might say. Special and differential treatment includes several specific rules and approaches that can be placed in three categories. First, non-reciprocity. Second, preferential market access. And third, permissive protection. First, in terms of non-reciprocity, S&D includes the concept initially expressed in the mid-1960s that poor countries will not be expected or requested to make reciprocal concessions in trade negotiations. They're not required to give up anything in this context. This vague principle was later incorporated in Part 4 of GATT. However, as several scholars have noted, those who are not required to reciprocate often find that few concessions are accorded to them, even under conditions of MFN. So the fact that developing countries are interested in particular products and now particular services means that unless they're available to give something in exchange for liberalization in those areas that they want liberalization themselves, they won't be successful in obtaining that. Second, special and differential treatment includes the aspiration to provide enhanced market access to developing country products. Partly because of the principle of non-reciprocity, this aspiration has often been ignored. The area in which S&D has had its greatest effect is in connection with the generalized system of preferences, which provides for reduced, often zero tariff treatment for certain developing country products. While the generalized system of preferences has provided modest benefits, it has not been applied to provide greater market access for many of the most important poor country products, including in areas like textiles and agriculture. And the United States and European community have imposed substantial conditions on access to their generalized system of preferences programs. You may have seen that India has challenged the EU's conditions, or at least some of the EU's conditions, for access to the generalized system of preferences. Third, special and differential treatment includes greater permission for protection, in particular under the balance of payments provisions of the GATT. As Michael Finger has pointed out, perhaps the least development-friendly side of the Doha Declaration is its willingness to ladle out special and differential treatment without a perception of where developing members would be better off if they themselves observe the disciplines the negotiations aim to establish. So this raises one of the greatest debates between economists, among economists today, the debate about whether unilateral liberalization by developing countries is an important part of their growth strategy, is a necessary part of their growth strategy or not. And obviously Finger takes the view that developing countries need to liberalize, need to avoid protection, and avoid using this special facility for additional protection. Let me turn to the question of market access for poor country products. There is a strong consensus that liberalization by the wealthy states in agriculture, textiles, and tropical products, even on a broad MFN basis, would assist growth in poor countries. For example, exports from developing countries are limited by continuing developed country tariffs, including quotas that were turned into tariffs in the Uruguay round, domestic supports, and export subsidies. And the recent decision to revise the common agricultural policy may help in this area. But market access in products of export interest to poor countries would be an important way to enhance livelihoods in those countries, although it is not unambiguous because easier exports to wealthy countries could mean higher prices at home. Reduction of wealthy country export subsidies on agriculture could hurt consumers in food importing states. Furthermore, reduction of barriers in wealthy states would have adverse effects on domestic persons involved in production of competing goods, often hurting the poorest segments of the wealthy countries. On the other hand, barriers often disproportionately raise the costs of basic goods to poor consumers. So poverty is a cosmopolitan phenomenon. Bhagwati has suggested that as agriculture in wealthy countries is principally the occupation of wealthier agribusinesses, it is less ethically ambiguous to liberalize in agriculture than in textiles or other manufactured goods. Tariff peaks and tariff escalation in connection with goods of export interest to poor countries has restricted market access not only in agriculture, textiles, and tropical products, but also in other manufactured goods. While developed country tariffs now average less than 5%, Hochman points out that tariff peaks, higher tariffs on particular goods, are often concentrated in products that are of interest to developing countries. Many of these apply to agricultural products, and they are often associated with tariff escalation, by which the tariffs on unprocessed products are disproportionately less than the tariffs on processed products, providing a disincentive for local manufacturing in developing countries. Tariff peaks may be a result of the principle of non-reciprocity, or maybe the result of simple political economy and of a desire to protect the jobs of the relatively poor in rich countries. While it is necessary and will be efficient for developed states to reduce barriers to developing country products on an MFN basis, it is also necessary to recognize the ethical and political need to take care of workers in competing industries in wealthier countries, as well as consumers in poor countries. Thus, while it is difficult to reduce these barriers because of the harm liberalization would do in wealthy countries, we must also recognize that trade barriers are not the most efficient means to help the poor in wealthier countries. Let me turn to an area that holds great promise and hasn't been addressed very much, and that is the issue of immigration and trade and services that involve the movement of people under the General Agreement on Trade and Services, the GATS. One way of ending global apartheid would be to allow workers from poor countries to take jobs in wealthier countries. The current global system of restricted migration may be understood in at least one dimension as a macrocosm of the internal passport system that was used under apartheid. Danny Roderick has pointed out that substantial benefit could be derived from liberalization of immigration to allow greater trade in labor. Efforts to block technological job exports to software development centers or call centers in India are analogous to limits on immigration. Absent transaction costs, trade in goods, immigration, trade in services applicable to goods, and even finance to some extent, are all fungible means of cross-border competition. Market access for services, including unskilled labor, of export interest to poor countries should also be liberalized. The General Agreement on Trade and Services focuses on services in which wealthier countries are more competitive, including financial services, telecommunications, professional services, etc., and concentrated on modes of delivery of services other than those that require immigration. By contrast, poor countries have tremendous advantages in unskilled and semi-skilled services, which were largely excluded from the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, both because their subject matter was not covered and because the mode of delivery by which these services may be traded is physical movement of the service provider. Little progress has been made in the Doha Development Agenda with respect to this type of movement of services, mode four, physical movement of the service provider. Of course, the adjustment issues that I mentioned earlier are applicable and more intense in connection with immigration. Immigration also raises more intense political issues, partly because it involves issues of access to host country social welfare programs, as well as issues of participation in host country politics. One of the areas in which we've all focused on the problem of poverty and the WTO is the area of TRIPS, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement, and its relationship to medicines access for poor people, principally with respect to AIDS, but also with respect to other diseases. It is clear that TRIPS has imposed significant costs on poor countries and on poor people. Viewed alone, TRIPS was a bad deal for poor countries. It may be that even as part of the broader Uruguay Round package, the so-called Grand Bargain, TRIPS was a bad deal for poor countries. One might say that the entire grand bargain in that context was a bad deal for poor countries. However, the problem of poor countries in this context, and more specifically of poor people in relation to TRIPS, is not necessarily the rules of TRIPS themselves, but the poverty of these individuals. One strategy that some have explored to seek to reduce the costs of AIDS and other medicines and relieve the burden of TRIPS on poor people is to argue for the modification or termination of the TRIPS agreement. If all other things remained equal, this would redistribute wealth from the wealthy to the poor, or one might say would reverse the redistribution effected by the original TRIPS agreement in 1994. But it would change the global level of intellectual property protection. It's not for me to say what the efficient global level of intellectual property protection might be. However, I would offer a view that in ideal circumstances, we would structure our arrangements to help poor people separately from our arrangements to set the efficient level of intellectual property protection. It would be much more efficient if we had the institutional infrastructure to do so, simply to transfer resources to the poor to enable them to acquire needed medicines. T.N. Srinivasan, a leading trade economist, concludes that compared to a policy of income transfers to the poor to enable them to buy drugs at a common world price, market segmentation is an inferior policy. Thus, it appears that the TRIPS AIDS problem might be optimally addressed by redistribution. However, we lack effective institutions for redistribution. Under these circumstances, there may be stronger arguments to modify TRIPS obligations themselves, or even to use human rights-based arguments to procure effective redistribution through abrogation of intellectual property rights. But we should be clear that this technique amounts to a global expropriation of the existing and fairly new rights of pharmaceutical companies. In any event, only a little has been done in the Doha Development Agenda to address the problem of TRIPS and drugs. Least developed countries have been given extra time before they are required to protect pharmaceutical patents. The problem for them is with the manufacturing capacities of the poor countries and the limitation on the permission for compulsory licensing under TRIPS. TRIPS requires that compulsory licensing, licensing ordered by the state, essentially taking away the rights of the original holder, must be predominantly for the domestic market. There was an agreement at Doha to try to revise this, but the United States has held back agreeing to many of the proposals. The United States has recently signaled that it will give up its efforts to limit the modification to a specific list of diseases, and pharmaceutical companies have shown some willingness to contribute to a solution, so perhaps there will be one soon. So far, I have suggested some of the limitations of trade law in connection with poverty alleviation. Measures taken thus far have been of limited effectiveness. In order to make progress, it is necessary to open rich country markets to products, services, and workers of poor countries, and to encourage appropriate liberalization in poor countries. Opening rich country markets will require redistribution within rich countries. In order to increase the export capacity of poor countries, and in order to alleviate poverty, especially in light of TRIPS, it is necessary to engage in greater redistribution from rich countries to poor countries. So, obviously, this is impossible. What is to be done in the interim? In the first part of this talk, I provided an ethical and rationalist argument for greater assistance to the poor. I've recognized the political barriers to any action along the lines I've suggested. In the second part, I showed the potential and limitations of the trade law system as it stands, recognizing the political barriers to action again. Obviously, it is uncertain whether any action can be taken, and any action that is taken will be shaped by many factors relevant to negotiations. By way of concluding, I wish to engage in a relatively conjectural, speculative exercise as to what types of actions might be considered and subjected to further research. There are two kinds of tools available to help the poor, as I've suggested. The tools that come most naturally to the trade system are those of improved market access and domestic reform. The second type of tool is international redistribution. Both tools seem appropriate to be used, and they can reinforce one another. Enhanced market access would allow the poor to increase their incomes through competition with people in wealthy states. Immigration by poor persons to wealthier states may allow them to achieve greater incomes and can also allow them access to the internal redistributive mechanisms available in wealthy countries. Increased investment in poor countries can provide the capital necessary to increase the returns to labor within poor countries and therefore to increase livelihoods. The point is factor mobility, breaking down the barriers of global apartheid and breaking down the jurisdictional limitations on competition. The WTO has the capacity and the mandate to coordinate reductions in barriers that impede flows of poor country goods and services, but has not yet addressed issues of labor mobility. While the WTO has not yet engaged in significant efforts to enhance flows of investment outside of the relatively modest efforts in the GATS and the TRIMS agreement, the trade-related investment measures agreements, it is not out of the question that the WTO would become more involved in liberalizing investment flows, as recognized in the Doha Ministerial Declaration. The type of investment flows that are needed, of course, are steady flows of capital that would provide a stable basis for enhancing local productive capacity. However, the TRIPS-AIDS problem that I've already mentioned illustrates too well that the fundamental problem of poor people and countries is that they are poor. Taxation and redistribution would often be a more efficient means to assist the poor in this case, as well as in other policy contexts, compared to modifying what would otherwise be the most efficient intellectual property production regime. At the same time that the poor are accorded greater opportunities to compete, greater aid is needed to provide the tools of competition: food, education, health care, and infrastructure. On Thursday, President Bush made another remarkable statement, saying that the promise of free markets means little when millions are illiterate and hungry or dying from a preventable disease. Given that many people in poor countries lack the nutritional, educational, health, and capital infrastructure to take advantage of enhanced market opportunities, transfers of resources are required to establish these conditions for participation in the global economy. It's easy to say that more money should be transferred to the poor, but the greatest barrier to poverty alleviation in many cases is weak or predatory government in the poor countries. Recent research suggests that domestic institutional quality is a more significant determinant of growth than geography or trade liberalization. Finally, let us emphasize the connection between liberalization and redistribution based on the cosmopolitan nature of poverty. In many instances, trade liberalization gives rise to substantial political costs. These costs may be paid through selective protectionism. Dissenting interests may be paid off through protection against competing imports. This is despite the fact that it might enhance global social welfare simply to pay direct compensation. However, direct compensation is more readily criticized and allows costs to fall fully on local taxpayers. On the other hand, protection often raises costs only to presumably more dispersed consumers and also diminishes the welfare of foreign persons whose interests are not directly taken into account in the domestic political system. In fact, we might suggest that one of the roles of trade law is to require that the domestic political system more actively take into account the interests of foreign persons in this connection. The point is that domestic redistribution is critical to efficient liberalization, just as international redistribution is necessary to poverty relief more generally. So what is the role of international trade lawyers or international economic lawyers in institutional reform? International economic lawyers can assist by participating in research efforts with economists and other social scientists to better understand the consequences of particular international economic law rules as they are applied. They can also participate in exercises of institutional imagination in order to evaluate what substitute legal rules and institutions are available and to develop predictions regarding their consequences. This work should be particularistic. That is, it should recognize that different countries are at different stages of development, have different social and institutional structures, and have different goals. In addition, international economic lawyers can participate with economists to develop methods to review international economic policy, and also domestic policy, of particular poor countries in terms not of trade liberalization, but of poverty reduction. In this regard, a variant of the WTO's successful trade policy review mechanism, perhaps including support, institutional support, from the UNCTAD, the IMF, and the World Bank, may be worthy of consideration. This development policy review mechanism would require careful, customized analysis. It would be driven by the particular circumstances and institutional structure of the subject state, rather than by a more general Washington consensus-type prescription. Perhaps the monitoring mechanism being discussed in connection special and differential treatment in the current negotiations would serve some of these purposes. The Heads of State Forum of the New Partnership for Africa's Development, the NEPAD, is a prototype of a more comprehensive mechanism. President Bush, in his remarks that I've already quoted, also suggested a commitment to conditionality of this type. He stated conditions for access to enhanced aid regarding just government and lack of corruption, investment in health and education, and economic freedom. Finally, and most speculatively, lawyers can assist in structuring appropriate international institutions to collect resources and redistribute them to poor countries. This is not a new proposal in international relations. As part of the Millennium Development Goals, wealthy countries have agreed to urge one another, they haven't agreed to actually do it, to make concrete efforts toward a target of 0.7% of their GNP as official development assistance to developing countries, and 0.15 and 0.20% of GNP of developed countries to least developed countries. Obviously, this is an intergovernmental and loose institutional structure. The proposals of the 1970s for a deep seabed authority to reap the harvest of, or the expected harvest of manganese nodules on the floor of the sea, and other seabed resources as a common trust for development may serve as a more transnational and institutionalized precedent. The fact that the wealth of the seabed is to a large extent not economically feasible to exploit does not prevent us from identifying other bases for aggregation of resources. The philosopher Peter Singer argues that the Earth's absorptive capacity is a common resource that should be shared on something approaching a per capita basis. Some have suggested utilizing a Tobin tax on foreign exchange transactions to fund redistribution. Of course, the European community internally funds its operations, including its redistribution, through customs duties, levies on agricultural imports, a portion of each member state's value-added tax, and an additional resource based on member state GNP. This could serve as at least a partial model for international arrangements. However, under circumstances of weak governance in many poor countries, in order to ensure that any redistributed resources are not misapplied, some international institutional monitoring and conditionality arrangements are necessary. This will have the beneficial effect of causing governments seriously to examine their development policy by removing moral hazard problems. If citizens could rely on unconditional global redistribution, they would lack appropriate incentives to cause their own state efficiently to achieve their goals. In economic terms, there would be a soft market constraint for political discipline on the state. A development policy review mechanism along the lines that I mentioned could be established to recommend a wide range of domestic and international policy prescriptions. For example, it could be authorized to recommend non-application of particular WTO legal rules by poor countries, and it could recommend particular domestic reforms. The WTO arrangements for balance of payments exceptions could be modified to serve as an institutional foundation for this type of structure. This would be a form of interventionism, and some will call it a form of neocolonialism. But sovereignty in the form of absolute state control over its own affairs has been oversold to poor small states, especially poor states that have weak governance. First, these states have little control simply because of their weak economic position. Second, as I suggest, local control is not of benefit to individuals when it is in the hands of predatory governments. We must be open to a post-colonial possibility of intervention in cases of failed domestic governance. If predatory governments can be disciplined through a regime of analysis, transparency, and conditionality, it is possible to improve the lot of their citizens. It may seem strange to be advancing greater international intervention and conditionality at a time when the policies underlying World Bank and IMF conditionality are hotly criticized. While international governance is quite imperfect, to the extent that it can engage in a policy dialogue with poor countries, it is possible that useful measures will result and will be less imperfect than the alternatives. Mechanisms need to be created to ensure and facilitate reasoned dialogue rather than diktat. Much will depend on the quality of governance in global institutions. What sort of constitutional moment would it take for wealthy states and poor ones to accept that these decisions might take place outside of national politics? For example, recent proposals for a bankruptcy reorganization type procedure for states, presumably administered by the IMF, in order to be attractive to wealthy states, might require poor states contingently to give up further control over their domestic policies, and could require wealthy states to provide additional resources in order to be attractive to poor ones. To what extent can the trade law system be harnessed to dismantle the barriers that form global apartheid and to redress inequality and poverty? While liberalization fits into the core tasks of the WTO, redistribution does not. I have not addressed the question of whether the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, the UN, regional organizations, or some new institutional structure would be the best way to proceed to attack the problem of poverty. However, it is increasingly obvious that the trade law system must not be seen to stand in the way of poverty reduction. Moreover, many believe that if the trade law system is not part of the solution, it is part of the problem. So apartheid in South Africa was both separate and unequal. Traditional liberalization can reduce the separation between the poor in poor countries and the rich in rich countries. However, greater equalization, greater redistribution is needed also, especially as both legal and informal separation will both endure for some time. Apartheid did not end immediately upon the world's recognition that it was wrong, and we cannot expect that global apartheid will end immediately. But understanding precedes action. I said at the outset that the theoretical grounding of this lecture is jurisdictional. Apartheid itself is a jurisdictional concept, allocating rights to some people but not to others. Change in the international trade law system will be of a jurisdictional nature. States have been and will be persuaded to give up some of their traditional rights to block competition from abroad in exchange for concessions by other states. This is jurisdictional. We will increasingly compare the rights and life opportunities of individuals from poor states with those of individuals from wealthy states. This will have two types of jurisdictional effect. First, it will help to discipline governments. Second, it will increasingly challenge the necessity of differences in life opportunities resulting from differences in jurisdiction of citizenship. This horizontal concern will increasingly cause us to reevaluate vertical governance, to examine the appropriate redistributive and other governance capacities of international government. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank Professor Trachman for a theoretically extraordinarily rich presentation. It was amazingly focused on a range of pragmatic solutions as well as discussion of the analysis and conceptual problems which have led to these issues in the first place. We now have about 15 minutes for question time, so I would ask you to keep your questions brief. Perhaps let us know your name and your institutional affiliation, and we'll take questions for about 15 minutes. Following that time, we'll close off at 7:20, and there is, I should tell you, a reception at 7:30 on the fifth floor, to which you're all invited, on the fifth floor in the senior common room, where we will have a brief moment to have a drink and meet with Professor Trachman. So let us start with some questions coming from all over the place now. Shall we start here, please?
Thanks very much. Thank you for a very stimulating talk. My name is Titus Alexander, and I introduced Thabo Mbeki to the concept of global apartheid when I gave him a copy of my manuscript of a book called Unraveling Global Apartheid in 1994, which was actually commissioned by the now director of the LSE. and I was very glad to hear that you were sympathetic to the kind of arguments that I was making, which was that apartheid is a form of one-sided protectionism. And the question I wanted to ask was about the wider question of effective participation in decision-making and enforcement of international rules and policy-making by the world's majority. Because, in other words, the political side of the argument that you set forth. Because as you touched on, that we have a hierarchy of citizenship based on national sovereignty with the G7 and UN Security Council permanent members at the top and stateless people at the bottom. So really the question is about the wider issue of participation of the world's majority in making of the rules and enforcing of the international rules, which would bring about the kind of redistribution that you've been advocating.
Well, thank you, and I apologize for not referring to your work. I think the question that you raise, though, relates to the structure of the international system and the structure of sovereignty, the background public international law rules, in which the way that global politics is carried out is through diplomats, through the representatives of states. And so for developing country people, the only way to be represented today in formal political contexts is through their governments. And there are two ways, there are several ways of thinking about this. One, some have suggested the utility of a WTO parliament or a global parliament, a way of providing perhaps some kind of direct representation for individual global society. Another is to refer to the efforts of non-governmental organizations which help to inform and help to support politics in different domestic societies and create a kind of transnational politics. A third, and the most likely, I think, to be useful in the near future, is to empower those domestic governments to provide support for the capacities for negotiation. And this is something that is being done actively, reasonably actively, at the WTO. It's a recognized need. One component of the problem is, I think, a small state problem, in that many small states really don't have the economies of scale to support a large negotiation apparatus. And so one possibility is for those states to join together, and I think we've seen that to some extent in the Caribbean and in other places where small states have joined together to try to increase their negotiating capacity or pool their negotiating capacity. Of course, with China's entry into the WTO, poorer states have a greater voice and have a champion along with India and Brazil and other large developing states. And so one would expect some greater forcefulness of developing country perspectives. Yes, please. Yes, I'll recognize you.
You mentioned Carl Polanyi, at least I think you're referring to him. I'm not sure whether it's someone else, because I was impressed. Many years ago, he wrote a book about the world economy, The Great Transformation,
yes, that's
1944, and I think it's still worth reading on the current globalization debate. And it is Professor Carl Polanyi. Do you think his ideas are still of relevance for us today, then?
I think so, and a number of others have suggested that. John Ruggie has updated a number of Polanyi's ideas to the current context. Danny Roderick and other leading economists have referred to Polanyi's work, and I think the Great Transformation, an economic history of industrialization here in Britain, is a very insightful treatment of these works, and what I was suggesting is just another extension of Polanyi's ideas as part of the background for this. Yes, please.
Reduction. You said domestic reform and the liberalisation of markets, and secondly, international redistribution. My problem is this: with the international redistribution, and, you know, wealthy states giving a percentage of their GDP to poorer states. At the moment, this isn't actually achieving anything because of the issue of bad governance in a lot of countries. For example, if a state, say, has £2 million, it says, well, what do we do? Do we build a road up to the mansion of, you know, the leader of the country, or do we build some, you know, do we give it in aid to the poor people? Well, the IMF gives them, say, another £2 million, and they can do both. So it's sort of, in some ways, in some countries where you have bad governments, you sort of encourage these corrupt governments. My problem with the domestic reform and liberalisation of markets is that the IMF has actually had some really absurd policies of encouraging the liberalisation of markets far too quickly, so that markets that exist actually collapse. It doesn't. I think liberalisation of markets is a good idea, but I think we need to say that it shouldn't happen quickly, and that we need to think about more the timing of liberalisation rather than trying to encourage it to happen really quickly. And one last point is that you've suggested that you think maybe the role of international trade lawyers should be to put research efforts and into institutional imagination, and maybe come up with some more institutions, maybe, you know, which will result in jurisdictional changes and people giving up their sovereign rights. I think that's very dangerous, because people who are suffering in poverty will have less of a voice. And surely it would be easier just to encourage the WTO and the IMF to be more accountable. And maybe international trade lawyers should put their efforts into forming some kind of judicial reform, so that the WTO and the IMF are actually accountable to the public of this world. After all, they are public bodies funded by our tax.
Well, on your second point to start, I think what I said was in agreement with that liberalization has to be sequenced carefully, although I think even the critics of the pro-liberalization consensus would agree that at some point in a country's development, liberalization will be appropriate, but the timing is quite important. Your first point relates to corruption and kind of money being wasted and spilled away. I think that really is a question, a particular question, to be looked at in particular contexts. Not every state has weak government. And I think that is the kind of conditionality, just to move from your first point to your third point, the kind of conditionality that is necessary to consider. I think at the World Bank and also at the IMF and to a lesser extent at the WTO, the greatest watchword is governance today. And that's what they're working on and hoping to support, and Bush is talking about that too. So that kind, what I was suggesting is that would be the kind of metric one would use to restrict sovereign rights. I guess I wouldn't say to restrict sovereign rights, but to avoid giving money, linking your first point to your third point, based on corruption or other failures to take appropriate policy steps. Now, The big question in what I've said, and you've pointed it out, is what are the appropriate policy steps to be taken? And I think that the answer to that question will differ from country to country, and we would need to have a procedure, a bureaucratic procedure, maybe a political procedure, to answer that question. In terms of accountability of the IMF and the WTO, one can't argue against accountability. It's of course intensely important. The big question for me is what is the best mechanism of accountability? All of our governments are representative governments. We don't have a direct democracy in any of our states, in the sense of we don't have parliaments. And so we rely on some delegation of political authority. And the question, which I don't have any answer to, is what is the appropriate delegation of political authority in the international trade context or in the international financial context? And so far, the international system uses diplomats. And one question about the use of diplomats brings us back to the domestic sector. How accountable are those diplomats in the domestic sector? Are we satisfied with that domestic accountability? If we are, we don't have to have a separate international accountability mechanism. I think one of the questions involved there is the question of whether domestic governance is sufficient, whether we really need global governance to make rules. And that is a question of subsidiarity and a question of competences. You and the European Union are struggling with those kinds of issues today. I think at some point the global system has to struggle with those issues as well. Yes, please. Let me let this man speak and then I'll come to you.
So I'll be fast, okay? Professor Noyal, you could very well address your moral lecture to not only to those grandiose G8 leaders, but also to those greedy, our third world country leaders as well. It's very nice. I would like to get your opinion about a few issues. Number one is the drug pricing, the double standards of the Western companies. Glasgow welcomed the English company when it was mad enough to litigate the South African government for HIV drug pricing. At the same time, it was very easy for your own President Bush to bring the Bayer ciprofloxacin price. So why not this? You can very well persuade him to do the same for all other common maladies like tuberculosis or malaria or diabetes or HIV. And number two is the same time. Again, thanks for supporting the talents of the poor world professionals. Both the National Health Service as well as your own New York Health Service relies entirely upon the healthcare workforce from the third world countries. At the same time, they do very little for our own medical institutions. So why is this? Because you poach us, and we come to you because the provisions are a little bit better than in our country. But at the same time, your leaders have got the moral responsibility to uplift our own institutions so that more and more people will come to you and some of us will do our own job in our own country. And finally, I would like to invite an invitation not only to visit your institution but to enroll in your great GMAP program. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't think I have to answer that. I appreciate the comments.
Can we really do justice to trade, poverty, and global apartheid unless we take into account the poverty taking place in countries already poor as a result of climate change, 70% of which is the result of the way of life of the rich 25% of the world's population, and which is undermining the ability of people in poor countries to take part in trade and competition in the way you suggest? Does not climate change in itself enormously reinforce the right of these people to come to countries in the rich north who have not yet so far been devastated by climate change?
I think it's a very useful point. I mentioned the work of Peter Singer, who has thought about those issues of climate change and absorptive capacity. And what Singer argues, which I think makes a lot of sense to a lawyer, is that we have to recognize that there are property rights in these resources that have been understood heretofore as being a commons, and we've had a tragedy of the commons in which the wealthy states have overused these resources. And so what Singer argues is for the pro rata division of those resources. And then, of course, the next step would be for the poor countries to say, okay, United States, because the United States is the biggest culprit, you need to pay up for this absorptive capacity that you've been using, and that perhaps not just going forward, but going backwards as well. So the argument is for a change in understanding of property rights. And I think it's a useful way to take a creative approach to legal rules and to recognize that the legal rules that exist promote a certain distribution of wealth and that there are other ways of understanding them. However, even though the rules that exist are unjust, in order to change rules, it takes a political process. And despite what George Bush has said, I think he still believes first things first is the American people, and he's not interested in giving up the American way of SUV life. So I think that it will take a good deal of politics and pressure to make even modest changes along the lines you've suggested. Okay, thank you. Yes?
Yes, my name is Paulette Gouge. I've just done some research into what I'm thinking about in relation to white racism. And I've been very interested since actually seeing your lecture advertised in The New Statesman, why the words global apartheid are in inverted commas. And I think I've got an idea, but I would like your answer to that, that it's because you don't mention anything to do with race or racism, and neither indeed is Titus Alexander's book, where he actually sets out in the introduction that it's really not about that. I would actually dispute that. And I would also base that on thinking, for example, you refer repeatedly to poor countries and rich countries. Well, actually, many of the poor countries, I've done a lot of my research in Nicaragua and Latin America, and many of the countries which are today very poor actually are very rich, are very wealthy in terms of their raw materials, in terms of basically what they have provided to initially Europe, including Britain, where we are now, latterly, I think, the United States, have provided huge amounts of raw materials to subsidize, in effect, our economic prosperity. And I would argue that actually changing that situation is not just a question of legal niceties, although I appreciate your particular perspective on that, and I think it's been very interesting for me to learn something about that. But I think it is also very fundamentally about questioning our attitudes in the UK and the US in particular, although other countries as well, which say it's okay to exploit, to dump on third world countries in a way that I think really does lock them forever into a kind of poverty. And I would argue it's no accident that what you call poor countries are also predominantly black countries, hence the issue that I would incorporate into that of a kind of first world racism towards third world countries.
Well, no, it's a wonderful comment. I think that we all can have, I don't have any special expertise. You've obviously done research. I don't have any special expertise as to the motivation, the racist motivation, if any, behind these rules. We all know that there's a colonial past to many poor countries. I don't know that anyone has conclusively or even suggestively proven that the colonial past is responsible for the current circumstance. And we can identify countries with, like the United States, with a colonial past that are now wealthier. So I'd like to see the data on that. I'd appreciate it. You know, if we're in the circumstance that we're in today, one question is, what is the importance of prior causation from an ethical standpoint? The Rawlsian approach doesn't really concern itself with causation of harm to others. It concerns itself with principles of justice, looking at the world as it is today. And I actually think that those are sufficient to argue for redistribution. And I'm not sure that the causation argument is necessary or persuasive. You said that many of these countries are rich. I frankly don't understand that. I don't understand how you measure wealth except by market prices of the resources that those countries command today. And maybe there is a way of evaluating that would suggest that they're richer than they look. The way I look at wealth is the way Dr. Cass suggested at the beginning, is in terms of the livelihoods of the people in those countries. And those countries are poor today by that measure.
My name is Esther Wenjie. I'm a law student here at the LSE. You may have touched on this, some of the people who commented, I think, touched on this, and you might have just done a little bit as well. But I was just wondering, you gave some sort of ethical reasons, arguments or principles for behind some of the proposals that you've sort of been stating. And you also pointed out some of the problems with those ethical reasons. And to me, those problems seem quite big ones. And I was just wondering whether perhaps you think that sort of the lack of sort of an ethical foundation as a form of motivation for some of these changes might be a problem, and whether there's people who do think that, and whether there are people who are looking into that.
Thank you. I really feel that the ethical foundations, taking the simple Rawlsian difference principle extended globally, are quite clear, and they at least convince me. Of course, in the world of ethics, we all have to follow our own compasses. I think those are very clear. I also think the embedded liberalism argument is quite plausible and even perhaps persuasive. The embedded liberalism argument is not an ethical argument. It's an argument from self-interest. So I actually think that there's really little to debate on the ethical side of this. The question is more of the practical question of how do you do it? How do you take from the rich and give to the poor in the political and legal setting that we have today? And it's a question of institutional change and a question of how to engage in political change in this decentralized public international law system. Just by way of conclusion, when I was a student here, I studied public international law. I wasn't smart enough to study economics or trade law. And that was because I felt, I was an idealistic youngster, I felt that if only the world would follow the rules of international law, there would be order. And so we needn't bother with politics or economics. And I think that that perspective of public international law, at least in the United States, I'm not sure it's true here, that idealistic, narrowly disciplinary perspective is still operative. I think that one of the things that will help us is to bring to bear some of these philosophical and economic and political perspectives to understand that these rules of law that we have, first of all, were created according to a particular political process. Second of all, are malleable in accordance with another political process. And third, there are ways through negotiation, through international politics, to make at least modest progress on some of these issues. Thank you.
Can I just thank, formally close the proceedings here. It's rare to hear someone merge insights from philosophy, economics, law, politics, and the nuts and bolts of the WTO system. If institutional imagination is what we're looking for, then I think Professor Trackman has given us a wonderful example of how it can be used. I myself am going to go away and think about what a post-colonial possibility looks like. But thank you very much to Professor Trackman, and I do again invite you all to join us for a reception on the fifth floor of this building in the senior common room if you want to continue these discussions. Thank you again, Professor Trackman.